Maker is next.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Our guest today is Jack Good, who is the author of the 2003 book, The Dishonest Church. Welcome, Jack. Can you hear me?
Steve, good to talk with you again.
We're talking to Jack Good in his home in Richmond, Virginia, by phone, and we'll be giving listeners a chance to ask questions and make comments later, but let's immediately start talking about this book. Now, your book is very critical of the Christian church, Jack. Why did you write such a book?
Well, I would like to rephrase that by saying I'm a loving critic of the Christian church. It's been my life, and yet I see a number of things that are happening that frighten me in terms of the church's long-range future. We send young men and women to seminary out of local churches where they've been trained through Sunday school in a particular style of faith, and in seminaries they learn how the Bible came into being, a kind of different approach to the Bible itself. They learn how creeds came into being. They learn to critique some of the dogmas of the church. Then they go back into local churches and preach as if none of that had happened and that they had continued with their same style of faith that they had before they went into seminary, because they do not want to disturb any of the people that they see as fragile in the church. And so churches then become kind of boring places, stale places where no new ideas enter, and people are dropping out. They're dropping out by the thousands, and I find that frightening. I think that churches ought to be the most stimulating and exciting places in society where ideas are confronted and wrestled with, and some embraced and some rejected. But there ought to be a marketplace of ideas within every local congregation, and that's not happening.
Now, you say that it frightens you what's happening in Christian churches around the world, particularly in the United States of America, but you're also angry. As I was rereading your book in preparation for our talk today, you say several times that you're angry at certain things that are going on. Yet you are a pastor, a part of the church, a member of a mainline Protestant denomination, the United Church of Christ. Why have you stuck with the church if you're so angry about what's happening in the church?
Because I think the church still holds the key to life that is deep and satisfying, and to a faith that is deep and satisfying. But it's not realizing that potential at the present time, and that's why I'm angry. Angry partly at the, to a large degree, at my fellow professionals who simply will not confront the issues that need to be confronted, and they do that out of fear that they might lose their job, that they might be seen as less than faithful. I'm also sometimes angry at lay people who sit back and let these things happen, just withdraw from the church rather than confronting the church professionals. So I stay with the church because I think it has so much to offer. I'm angry at the church because it isn't offering as much as it could.
In our program today, we've advertised it as hearing some of the responses to your book that came out a year ago called The Dishonest Church. And I might just say that the book is published by Rising Star Press, and we'll be quoting from it by permission of the author who has the copyright for the book that we're talking with today, Jack Good. And we talked with Jack when this book first came out because I could tell that it was going to be something that was going to cause a lot of reaction. And during the past year that the book has been published, there's been quite a bit of furor about it, quite a bit of discussion. And I wanted to bring some of that discussion to our listeners who heard Jack talk about this book I guess we actually talked the week before it came out, as I recall.
Yes, it was. Well, it was either the week before or the week of its appearance.
Right. And but let's get clear for new listeners, particularly what the book is about. What are the main concerns you have that you list in your book, The Dishonest Church?
Well, the main concern, as I say, is that we have this divide between the professional and the laity.
And by professional, you mean the pastors, the priests, the rectors,
the bishops,
the preachers.
All right. Folks like you and me, Steve, and the laity. And part of that is a lack of trust. The clergy, the professionals do not seem to trust the laity that they can deal with issues that the professionals have dealt with in their educational experience. And so they withhold information. I have a great deal of concern about the way the Bible is handled. The Bible becomes a literal statement of the Word of God to certain people, and others find that that's impossible. They find contradictions in the Bible, and so they want another way to handle the Bible, a way that shows great respect, that cherishes the Bible but does not take it literally. And that is not offered to people in most Protestant churches today. I'm concerned about the relationship between religion and science.
Let's save religion and science for just a minute, if we can, Jack. And let me just follow up with on that first issue. Could you give us an example, perhaps one you gave in the book would be good to recount, about when you were in one of your, maybe it was your first parish or at least one of the early congregations you served, and you preached a series of sermons on what you did not believe. And I think one of the examples you give in the book is about the virgin birth.
That's correct. And I had a series of sermons on what I do not believe, and I indicate in the book if I had that to do over, I'd probably name it something else.
not quite so negative, maybe.
That's right. But I was really attempting to put the problem out in front, and I did. A series, I believe, of six sermons, but one of them was on the virgin birth. And on that, I did, as in all of them, I did not try to say to people, if you believe in a literal virgin birth, you have to set that aside. I did not attack people's beliefs. I simply tried to broaden their alternatives, and I simply indicated that most scholars of the mainland Protestant churches feel that the birth stories were later additions to the Gospels, that they were rather poetic and lovely ways of expressing the uniqueness of Jesus, but not stories to be taken as literal truth, and I identified that position as my own. And the response to that was very positive. I expected people to be very upset, to challenge me on that, but as I indicate in the book, many people went out afterwards on Sunday morning and simply shook my hand and said, thank you. I've been thinking that a long time, and it's good to hear that from the pulpit. Now, I do not guarantee that every pastor and every congregation would be so positively received in that, but I think they would be surprised how many people would embrace that. And again, it's not a question of challenging people's faith. It's simply a question of here are some alternatives, or it's an issue of here are some alternatives, a different way of going about that.
And when the early Christian church first put together some of the statements of what people believed and included the phrase in it, I referred to born of a virgin, born of the Virgin Mary, Jesus was born of the Virgin Mary, phrases like that. Do you think that they were not interpreting that literally at that point?
I think probably at that point they were interpreting it rather literally. But that was not immediately after Jesus' birth. We're talking about 300 to 400 years after Jesus' birth that some of this came into being. And I think at that point they lived in a different kind of world, a different relationship between the spirit world and the material world. And I think they mostly, at least, were accepting that as literal. I think there were some church fathers, and maybe you can footnote that better than I can, who indicated that that should be received mythologically. But most of them, I think, were taking it literally. That does not mean that we in the 21st century have to take that literally. They were certainly indicating that, as I said earlier, that this was a way of pointing to the uniqueness of Jesus.
Now, you use some new terms in your book, or you encourage the use of new terms like truth stories, as opposed to something being either true or false. What do you mean by seeing the virgin birth as a truth story, although not necessarily literally true?
Yes, and I just violated my own rule by referring to mythological, because myth is one of those words which in an academic setting people accept as a deeper kind of truth. But I think most people who go to churches on Sunday morning hear the word myth quite differently. So I'm suggesting that we just refer to some of these stories as truth stories, and I see that visually, I see that as a container that holds the truth, but is not the truth itself. So in the birth stories, for instance, I see the truth of something unique happening in Jesus, something that brings joy to the world, as they say in the Christmas stories. But that does not mean that every detail of that story has to be accepted. As a matter of fact, that's pretty clear in the Bible, because the birth stories that are in Matthew and the birth stories that are in Luke are quite different and in some ways contradictory. So it's not the specific information that needs to be accepted. It's the truth that is carried within those stories that Christians, followers of Jesus, are encouraged to embrace. That's what I mean by a truth story.
Let's talk a little bit about how people have responded to your book, in this, particularly in this regard. There have been reviews of your book. There have been discussions of your book. Your book has been used in many congregations as a discussion starter. What feedback has come back to you, particularly on this issue, on the whole notion that there are parts of the Bible that can contain truth, although they may not be literal descriptions?
You know, I have had surprisingly little negative feedback on this. I've had a number of other interviews with other talk shows around the country, most of them in the South, and most of those with hosts who were basically hostile to my ideas, although they were quite polite. And in some of those, I have received concerns from people who were angry at what I was saying. I have, as far as I can know myself, not received a bad review on the book as a whole. Most reviews have been positive about that. I have had feedback from churches that were using it as a study guide, in every case very positive. People find these ideas freeing, again, because I think I'm not attacking old faith. I'm trying to broaden people's alternatives and to let them see that there is a different way to go about faith. So it's been surprisingly positive.
Let's move to the topic of the Bible and science, or Christianity and science, since that's an important segment of your what you talk about in your book. And for new listeners, let me repeat again. We're talking on the phone with Jack Good, who is the author of The Dishonest Church, published by Rising Star Press in 2003. And we're talking about responses to this book. We learned about it about a year ago when the book first came out, and we're hearing now about how people have reacted to it. Tell us a little bit about your approach to science.
Yes, there are several approaches that that people take towards science. Some see science and religion as antagonists. I very much reject that. Some see it as two different spheres which overlap to some degree. I basically reject that, too. I see religion and science as two approaches to mystery, the mystery of the universe, with a capital M. Science tends to see mystery as a challenge and tries to solve it. Religion tends to see mystery as a blessing and tends to embrace it. That does not mean that they are antagonists. It simply means that they approach that the questions, the deeper questions of life, somewhat differently, and I also see them as nourishing each other. I think religion has much to contribute to science in terms of what you do with new science and new information, whether you use it to build weapons of mass destruction or whether you use it to cure disease. I also think that science has much to contribute to religion. I spell out some of the symbols of the Christian church that become richer as we know about science. Light, for instance, and all the mystery that light implies, how much science does not know about light. Makes it a very rich symbol of the divine and what the divine does in human life. Every time that science tends to have a breakthrough, they break through into some new knowledge, but the new knowledge raises new mysteries. And so in that sense, I find it very stimulating. I'm stimulated by science and would like for other religious people to see that as an ally in the search for deeper truths.
Let me give the phone number so that listeners may make comments or ask questions to our guest. We're talking with Jack Good, the author of The Dishonest Church. If you'd like to ask him a question, make a comment, argue with him, that's fine. The number anywhere the program is heard, there's a free call can be made at 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL, the call letters of the station here in Urbana-Champaign. In the Twin Cities, you may call several local lines by punching in 333-9455. So in Urbana-Champaign, it's 333-9455. Elsewhere, 1-800-222-9455. And we're happy to have your question or comment go directly to our guest on the phone from Virginia. While we're waiting for those callers to decide if they want to enter the conversation, let's continue talking a little bit about science and Christianity. In your book, you talk about types of philosophy that help you think together about science and religion, which, as you've pointed out just now, you don't see in conflict. But you mentioned particularly the whole notion of process philosophy and also process theology. I know that's a hard topic to talk about anywhere, and particularly in a few short sentences possible on a radio program that's only an hour long. But give us a shot. What's helpful to you about process philosophy and process theology in relation to science?
Well, partly the word process itself I find exciting, that we are not stuck at any one point in life, that we are not fixed at a point, but that we can evolve towards new insights. And of course, Whitehead and his exploration of this saw God also as evolving in relationship to the universe, in relationship to people. As people change, the relationship with God changes. It's somewhat in any friendship that when one person changes somewhat, the other person changes in relation to that. So process theology says that people are changing, the world is evolving, and that God is adjusting to that and evolving with that. And I just find that extremely exciting and hopeful. You might add something to that, Steve. I know that you have some insights into that also.
Well, I've also found that a helpful way to think about the world and God's relation to the world. But let me not let you squirm out too quickly from that. In using the term God, you see problems with using the word God in the Christian faith, even though the term is on almost every other page of the Bible. Tell us why that term is difficult for you and why you prefer terms like the divine or even a stranger term to many of us, the Newman.
Yes, and I should say that in terms of feedback, I have had a good deal of feedback about that particular issue. And for those people who find terms like the Newman helpful, it's very helpful. Those who find it not helpful, they find it not helpful at all. And I think that's quite understandable. The word God, of course, carries such baggage. Most of us grew up thinking of God as a kind of overgrown human being, type being who lived perhaps on a cloud not too far from planet Earth, and who came back occasionally to intervene when needed. A very anthropomorphic concept. I'm not really suggesting that we can set aside the word God. I'm suggesting we might think about that as a way of trying to move beyond some of the baggage that that word carries. And so I did suggest some other ways of approaching this. The word mystery, with a capital M, or ultimate mystery, I think defines what I experience in my own life, which I call God or the divine. But I'm fascinated with the word Newman, and I came across that out of the writings of Randolph Otto. Rudolph Otto, who was exploring the meaning of the divine. And he refers to numinous realities, those realities that simply seem to glow with the depth and the spiritual meaning. And I began to do some work with the word itself and found that it grows out of the concept of noumen. And in some of the animalistic religions, the noumen is that which gives a spider its role as a spider, gives a rock its role as a rock, a kangaroo its role, and a human being as its role. And so each of us could say that we have our own noumen. But then the universe itself has its noumen, and that is what we call the divine, or usually called God. Paul Tillich referred to the God who appears when the gods we create have disappeared. And I think that it helps me to put a different name on that and to say that might be what I've referred to as the noumen. Again, it's a strange concept and one that many people find helpful, others do not find helpful. I'm simply trying to say that the word God itself needs to be re-examined. I refer, as you might recall, in the book to the experience of N.T. Wright, who was a chaplain at one of the British schools, and young people would come in and say, "I don't believe in God." And Wright would respond, "That's interesting. Tell me about the God you don't believe in." And they would describe this God that one of my parishioners called once a cosmic bellhop, who was constantly running errands for people. And at the end of that, Wright would simply say calmly, "But God that you do not believe in, I do not believe in either." And that would elicit some conversation and points of agreement. So I'm simply saying that we need to re-examine that God and to admit that the God many people do not believe in, I do not believe in also. And using some different terminology seemed a path towards that goal.
The term noumen that Jack Good is using is spelled N-U-M-E-N, as in numinous. One of the things you find difficult about the traditional term God is that, as pointed out by many feminist theologians, there's the tendency to think of that God as masculine in
exactly,
in
and there
Western
are gods and
Christian
there are
tradition.
Goddesses, and so if we call ours God, we have almost automatically taken out the feminine aspect of that. And that's one of my problems. That's part of the baggage that the word carries, mm-hmm. One of the most tragic parts of the baggage.
Again, we're talking with Jack Good by phone from Richmond, Virginia. Jack is the author of several books, the most recent of which is the one we're discussing today called The Dishonest Church. An earlier book of his also dealt with the understanding of the Bible, and that's part of the title of his earlier book, The Bible Faith's Family Album by Chalice Press, that came out in 1998. Jack's current book has been out about a year. It's a 2003 publication by Rising Star Press. And we might just ask, Jack, if people are interested in reading this book, how may they find it? Of course, going to bookstores, but is there a website the press has?
There is a website, and it's www.risingstarpress.com.
And this book is also published in association with the Center for Progressive Christianity. And can people order the book through that source as well?
They could, yes.
And that website is
tcpc.org.
All right. So two places.
And Amazon
online.
On the web, and
sure.
Barnes & Noble on the web both carry the book.
Okay. And many local bookstores as well, I'm sure.
Yes, but most of them would find that they would have to order it, but any bookstore would be able to order that.
Mm-hmm. And the book has sold well, and that's unusual for books of this type. Why do you think people have been interested in it?
I think this strikes a nerve. I think there are many people who have been faithful to the church, sat in pews, listened to sermons all their lives, and yet had a gnawing feeling that something was being withheld, that it could be different, that it could be more exciting. And some of those have dropped out, as a matter of fact. Several of the people that I know who have read the book affirmed that this told their story and they were no longer a part of the church and were saying, this might motivate me to come back into the church and try again, or to come back into some different branch of the church and try again. So there's been that kind of response.
When people have been critical of your perspective during your long career as a pastor, you've been a pastor in several states over 40 years of time. When people have disagreed with your approach, what have they mainly focused on?
I think they have sensed that their particular style of faith was not being reinforced, not being challenged, in that, as I've indicated, but not being reinforced. And many people who want reinforcement for a faith that no longer really fits in the modern world want that to be reinforced in many ways, otherwise it falls apart. And so they've been frightened by the fact that I was not in the business of reinforcing their faith and have become angry about that. Although the number of those has been surprisingly small, partly because I spent most of my pastoral time in a tradition where pastors choose churches and churches choose pastors. And I think search committees sensed where I was and what I stood for, and that the system worked well in bringing me into churches would have tended not to be threatened by that. And again, I'm not guaranteeing that someone in another setting, in another church, might not be challenged more than I have been. But there's been surprisingly little anger, and I think I can name only three or four families that have ever left a church because of disagreement with me. Many have come to argue with me, and I've tried to approach that pastorally and explore with them where they were and let them know that I did not object to where they were, as if it was working for them. So it's created a good deal of dialogue, but again, surprisingly little actual animosity.
We're about halfway through our program, and let me take a break. We'll be getting back with our guest, Jack Good, in a moment, and I particularly want to follow up on some of the understandings of the Center for Progressive Christianity that is one of the publishing partners in this book, and learn more about the Center for Progressive Christianity. But let me take just a break to let listeners know who will be our guests on upcoming programs. You're listening to Keeping the Faith, a weekly program here on WILL AM 580, a radio service of the College of Communications of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for this program. And coming up next week, we'll be talking about fasting and spirituality from three different religious traditions. We'll be talking with a Muslim, a Baha'i, and a Hindu about the practice of fasting in each of those religious traditions. On December 12th, we'll be learning about the Eastern Illinois Food Bank. Our guest will be Jessica Culp. On December 19, we'll be talking about faith and politics, and we'll be talking with Anne Heyer, who is a journalism student who's been doing interviews on that topic all during October and November this year, so it's quite current, and we'll get have the first chance to hear some of her interviews on those topics. That's on December 19th, Sunday from 5 to 6, here on Keeping the Faith. Support for these Keeping the Faith programs is provided in part by the University YMCA at the University of Illinois, where I am the executive director. The Y is the oldest religious institution at the university. It was started by students back in 1873. And over the last 131 years or so, the Y has been providing opportunities for students to develop their leadership skills by practicing social action on important topics like the environment and education, and to provide community service on alternative spring break trips and through tutoring and mentoring programs and many other activities provided at the Y. We're located at 1001 South Wright Street in Champaign, and we are a charity that receives no money from the university budget or from the state budget. Rather, we count on our friends to help us continue this important work. People who believe in this kind of values education as part of a university. The Y accepts donations, and if you'd like to make a contribution, you may mail us a check made out to University YMCA at 1001 South Wright Street, Champaign, Illinois, 61820. We have a website, universityymca.org. You can see some of our many programs and make a donation that way as well. We also accept automobiles, trucks, motorcycles. The people donate, and then they can take the value of those cars off on their taxes if they itemize as a donation to a charity. That way they don't have to go through the hassle of selling it themselves or trading it in. We, in turn, take those vehicles and sell them most often to students, but other people in the community as well. That helps the Y's budget and also helps people get a good car at a bargain. So if you'd like to consider making a donation of a vehicle to the University YMCA, give me a call, Steve Shoemaker, 337-1500. That's in the 217 area code. Well, getting back to our guest, Jack Good, we're talking about his book, The Dishonest Church, and I was mentioning before my little ad for the Y that the Center for Progressive Christianity is one of the publishers of his most recent book, The Dishonest Church. Tell us a little bit about the center, Jack.
It started several years ago as a way of bringing together or mutually reinforcing congregations that were doing some of the things that I've been indicating, exploring the faith at a broader level. And it is not a denomination in itself, but it includes churches of many denominations and campus ministries, by the way. Several campus ministries through the state of Illinois are part of the Center for Progressive Christianity. It provides resources and books. Mine was the first to be published under its auspices to churches that are exploring new horizons in faith. And it has grown and is now international. In fact, in April, I will be going to Toronto and helping to deal with a conference that will be setting in motion a Canadian branch, Canadian edition of the Center for Progressive Christianity. They also have groups in Australia and England and Ireland and France and a number of other nations, and so it's growing rapidly.
And what are the principles that congregations who are part of this group affirm?
In my book on page 142, if anyone happens to have it in front of them, I have the eight principles that the Center for Progressive Christianity puts before people. They have been slightly reworded since I put this in. That's the problem of putting something in print. As soon as you have it in print, something changes. But anyway, this still gives the basic principles. And as I look over those eight principles, I'm aware of how much the Center for Progressive Christianity stresses the inclusiveness of faith rather than the exclusiveness of Christianity. They stress that we believe that Jesus is for us the doorway to God, but we also stress that other faiths have other doorways by which they can approach the divine. In fact, I think I heard you say just now that you'd be talking to some people of various faiths next Sunday night, and I think the assumption behind that is that each of them has their valid way of approaching the divine, the noumen. And as you go through the principles, there is a redrawing of the circles, so that instead of drawing circles to keep people out and saying these are the people who have the right dogma and therefore they're inside the circle, effort to redraw the circle and include as many as people, many people as possible. For instance, the fourth is to invite all people to participate in our community of worship life without insisting that they become like us in order to be acceptable. So it's that type of thrust that comes out of the Pergott Center for Progressive Christianity.
Let me emphasize that notion of inclusiveness by encouraging listeners who either agree or disagree with our guest today to call and make a comment. 1-800-222-9455 is a toll-free call. That's 1-800-222-WILL. In Champaign-Urbana, listeners may punch in 333-9455 to be on the air with our guest today, Jack Good. In terms of progressive Christianity, I noticed that one of the principles that they focus on is that followers of Jesus, those who are would identify themselves as Christians, that it entails selfless love, conscientious resistance to evil, and renunciation of privilege. Now, those are things that that are costly, as this Principle 8 mentions. Is that a challenge to the American Christian church that tends to be complacent and rather happy in its privilege?
I would hope that it's a challenge to the churches, because I think they need a challenge at that point. As I look around at the churches in this border state, or maybe it's a southern state, I fear at times that the churches tend to see themselves as an extension of the American War Department, rather than a group of people who insist that we take a different view of issues such as war and violence. So yes, I would see that this costly kind of discipleship, this following of Jesus, which Jesus defined as taking up our own crosses and following him, I would hope that that might become a genuine challenge to Christianity as it exists in the Western world, and especially as it exists in the United States.
We have a couple callers waiting to join their conversation with our guest who's speaking to us by phone from Roanoke, Virginia. Let's go to line one. You're on the air with Jack Good. Go ahead, please. Yes, line one.
Yes. I attended a Southern Baptist seminary back before the great witch hunt that they had in the 80s and 1990s.
Yes.
And I left the seminary with about a year to go, partly because of the kind of things you're talking about, that I saw that I wouldn't be able to really think for myself, or at least if I, that I wouldn't really be able to share these ideas and actually keep a job. I remember professors, you know, referring to this, to certain theological points, saying that, well, you know, in my view, there are two valid points on this issue, valid views, but if you want to keep your job, you believe this one. And, you know, we laughed about those kinds of things, but really, you know, if a minister is in a Southern Baptist church and begins to doubt some of these things, or has already concluded long since that really things are not the way the people in the pews think, you know, what's that person to do?
Now, the person being the one in the pew or the one in the pulpit?
The one in the pulpit.
Yeah, that's a tricky question, and I do not mean to underemphasize the dangers involved. One of my chapters is entitled, has to do with acceptable pain in this, and you're talking about the risk that's involved. I would suggest that if a person, a pastor, goes about this in a pastoral way and shows respect for people, loves the people in the first place, and says to them, "I respect you enough to share this," I think that the reactions will not be as negative as we sometimes assume. And some of it is simply indicating what is obviously in front of them. For instance, if you're dealing with the Bible, to say that there's not just one creation story in the Bible, there are two creation stories, and you don't have to be any sort of theological expert to identify that, you can simply show them, here's the creation story in chapter 1. It goes, I believe, into the first three or four verses of chapter 2. And then show them where creation story starts all over again in, I believe, the fourth chapter of the second, fourth verse of the second chapter of Genesis. Just to lay that in front of people, to lay in front of them where the development of the Christology is seen in the Bible. The synoptic Gospels have one view of Jesus which emphasizes his humanity. The Gospel of John begins to emphasize his divinity. Paul, who was writing before the Gospel, saw Jesus pretty much as a person, a human being, who became divine at his resurrection. But these are things which are just so clearly in front of people that once they are pointed out, they cannot be escaped. To do that rather than to deal in what I believe and don't believe is helpful. To do a lot of it in educational circles where people can talk back to you. I think part of our problem in the church is that we do so much of this on Sunday morning in the sermon context where people just have to sit and endure it and have no way to talk back. In educational settings, people can speak back and deal with their feelings as well as their thoughts. So these are some of the ways I think it can be done, but I do not mean to underemphasize the fact that it's risky and that there are some people who lose their jobs because of this. They do not lose their integrity, however, and I think you and I are both agreed that that there are lots worse things than losing your job, and losing your integrity is one of those things. I indicated in the book that I made this decision before I preached the series of sermons on what I don't believe, that if this meant losing my job, then so be it. I'd have to do something else. But I could not go through 40 years of pastoral ministry hiding from people what I truly believe. I certainly empathize with your position.
I want to thank that caller for raising that very good question. We do have another caller waiting. Let's go to line number 2. You're on the air with our guest, Jack Good. Go ahead, please.
Howdy. Steve, I remember taking your class, and I remember writing a paper on 1 Thessalonians or 2 Thessalonians. And the question is, it seems like I'm not even sure I have a question, but it seems like we are headed for a dark time of exclusion, religion excluding groups and tighter and tighter restrictions. And it seems like that's contrary to the whole message of the New Testament, which is inclusion, where you include everything. I don't know if I have a question, but I have a real concern that we are in a tightening time instead of a widening time, Dr. Good. And what you're probably addressing this, and you probably have addressed this, but what can anybody do? Aren't we supposed to be inclusion, including more and more groups and more types and more people?
Well, you're doing it right now. We need to keep pointing out the fact that we progressive Christians are not the ones who are departing from the Bible. The Bible is a book of inclusion. Now, there are places where you can quote various isolated statements that make it sound exclusive. But certainly Jesus as a whole, certainly 2 Isaiah, the creation stories themselves, all that rich material that grows out of the exile, all of this keeps drawing the lines wider and wider to include more and more people. And so your paper on either 1 or 2 Thessalonians was right on target, and we need to keep stressing that. And what Steve raised a few minutes ago, these costly things of searching for justice, for instance, and pursuing concerns about war and peace, these are costly things, but they're biblical things, and the Bible is on our side about this. The Bible says relatively little about how to get people into heaven. It says a great, great deal about justice and righteousness and how you distribute the goods of society so that everyone, as Micah said, is able to live under his own vine and fig tree where none will make them afraid. You can check that out in any good concordance. Look up the word justice. And compare it to the number of times the word salvation is used in the Bible. The Bible is on our side as progressive Christians, and what you're doing right now is pointing that out. I hope you keep pointing that out in conversations and in your church.
It's always good to hear from former students. I do have to admit I've taught courses on the Bible and Christianity at both the University of Illinois and at Parkland College. And
you've apparently done a good job.
And have tried to raise some of these issues. We have a couple other callers waiting. Let's go to line number one. You're on Keeping the Faith with Jack Good. Go ahead.
I grew up in a Sabbath school and church where we learned to take everything in the Bible literally and believe that that was a very valid way of understanding the Bible. And then as years have gone by, I've seen it in many other ways. And one of the most exciting things I find in modern biblical studies is the idea that, of dating the sources of the different things that are recorded in the Bible and comparing what the earliest were. I just read the other day that Paul was the earliest eyewitness to the resurrection, and so reading what he had to say about the nature of the resurrection is very fascinating, and that's clearly stated in his writings. What do you think about the importance of evaluating scriptures in terms of when they were written and by whom?
Glad you raised that question, because the book that Steve has referred to, that I wrote a few years ago, takes the books of the Bible in the order in which scholars seem to mostly agree that they were written, which means that the 8th century prophets were the first books put together in their final form, Amos probably being the first of these. And when you see that, and Amos's emphasis upon social justice, you see that that line was laid down from the very beginning. And then these other rich resources out of the Hebraic scripture evolved from there, many of them coming out of the exile. And when you read the material coming out of the exile without recognizing that it was done when these people were devastated, their land was lost, and their God was lost, really, they thought God had deserted them. When you read it without recognizing that, you've missed the deeper implications of it. And then you go to the New Testament, and what you're saying is so absolutely correct. You need to recognize that Paul came first. He wrote the first books of the New Testament. The Synoptics probably were after that, then the Gospel of John, and then some other things followed after that. And Revelation was probably not the last to be written. So seeing it in the order in which they were written and the themes that then run through those and how they were argued back and forth and the issues over which there were disagreements and what is the meaning of suffering, for instance, which took a real different turn when the exile came. So that's more than you may have wanted to hear, but as a matter of fact, I applaud what you were saying, and it's been my approach to the Bible for some time.
And that book that Jack Good wrote earlier, and it was published in 1998 by Chalice Press, that's C-H-A-L-I-C-E, Chalice Press, was titled The Bible Faith's Family Album, that took that approach of looking at the Bible as presenting several pictures within the family of faith from various times that show up as various books in the Bible. We have another caller waiting, again on line two, a local line. You're on Keeping the Faith. Yes.
Hi. I tuned in sort of late, but I want to ask your guest this question. My husband is MD, and I'm an RN, nearly 70 years old. We have three boys. My question is, how do you, in this century, help people to understand the faith? I know that each of our boys believes something different. That's okay. Diversity is the way it is. But how do we, as parents, teach, make people feel secure, make people feel that there is a meaning, make people feel like there's a direction in this troubled world? And I'll hang up and listen to my answer off the air. I know. I'm sorry to say I turned in late, but anyway, have you addressed this issue? We need religion, but religion is full of holes. Thank you.
The world is indeed full of horror, and I sympathize, empathize with your dilemma. I applaud the fact that your children have gone in various directions, and I think keeping dialogue open between all of them is very important. A couple of things that I mentioned in the book I think might be helpful, too. I am convinced that if we are to continue to help people see that there is depth in life, that religion is the lens through which we see life at its broadest and not a set of dogma, that becoming more friendly with science, as we have been discussing earlier, is one of the avenues that allows that to happen. And then I spent a bit of time in the book, and a bit of ink in the book, talking about the fact that we need to be friendly also with the arts. I think artists are people who are able to see the depth of life and speak to the remainder of us about that. When I see, for instance, a painting or hear something of the Beethoven violin concerto, I'm transported to something deeper in life that cannot be denied. And so I think these are some of the ways that we must go. Teaching dogma, I think, is not going to do it. It's not going to do it within your family. I think it's not going to do it within society as a whole.
Let me ask a question about something that's very central to your book, since you're dealing mainly with Christianity and, yes, the Christian religion within a interfaith setting. But nevertheless, you as a Christian pastor, a Protestant pastor, are dealing with Christianity. Of course, Jesus is central. And in your chapter 7 of your book, The Dishonest Church, you say, Jesus, answer man or puzzle maker. What kind of distinction are you trying to draw with that title?
I was trying to draw the distinction, since I've just mentioned art, is that between a very realistic painting and an impressionistic painting. And the impressionistic painting draws the viewer in and makes the viewer have to supply part of the answer that the artist is suggesting. And what I was trying to say in there is that Jesus is more like an impressionistic artist who suggests answers but trusts people enough and respects them enough to say, you too can be part of this process, along with Walter Wink, who I greatly respect. I believe that Jesus saw himself as a kind of Messiah figure, but the Messiah figure in the Jewish tradition was a very human figure. And I think Jesus saw his role as opening up the Messiah and all of us and empowering other people to be able to heal, to preach, to see truth, to answer mysteries. And so he spun out stories that were not finished, that were not realistic paintings, but were impressionistic and called upon the hearer to supply part of the answer. It's part of his challenge to us and the way he draws us into faith.
Do you see Jesus as divine, as being part of the ultimate mystery in some way different than most folks, all folks?
Jesus was, as I use the term in the book, translucent. I think he was so much in touch with the depth of his own life that people were able to look at him and see in him that glow of divine. Certainly more than almost anyone else, maybe more than anyone else. But there was something in terms of their life that was indeed unique to Jesus, which challenged them to give up their own lives and to follow him, and in many cases to give their own lives for that. Now, whether that means that he is... I'll back up and say that again. I do not believe that Jesus was in some way so different from the remainder of humanity that we cannot be like him. I think he invites us to move towards that. I do not see in myself the ability to ever become that translucent myself. But I think Jesus challenges me to move in that direction. I think he challenges all of us to move in that direction.
And you would see the possibility for at least some becoming saints.
Yes, absolutely. And I think we have seen in our own lifetimes some people really achieving that goal and becoming translucent in themselves.
We're down to our last three or so minutes of the program and don't have time for any more calls, and I apologize for the listeners who weren't able to get on the air, but let me just ask one last sort of series of questions on the clergy crisis. You see that religious professionals within Christianity are often in crisis. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
I think many of them, as one of the earlier callers was suggesting, in crisis because of the integrity issue, that they see themselves as pretending to have a kind of faith that they have long since given up. And that leads to a kind of depression, leads to less effectiveness in their work. And we lose a lot of very good pastors because of that. So seminaries are not as full as they would like to be. They have found a number of people who come back into... or come into seminaries late in life who have already developed a certain depth, and I think those people are able to handle all that much better. But yes, I think people in clergy are in the profession of the clergy are in crisis. I sensed that all through my pastoral ministry. Whenever I went to clergy meeting and heard people talk, and in the clergy meeting they were able to be more honest and to share their own doubts and to share the problems that they have relating to people because of that. So I would say they're in crisis.
And how would you see people in the pew? What can they do to help make their pastors, priests, ministers more honest?
I think that people in the pew have a real role in this, and that when they become uncomfortable, rather than just packing up and leaving, which many of them do, like ships in the dark, they just disappear. Rather than doing that, they need to go to their pastor and to say, look, I do not find this as challenging as I would like. I have questions that you're not addressing. And I would be receptive to you if you raised questions about the traditional faith and if you encouraged all of us to think more broadly. I think for people to go to pastors would empower the pastors to recapture their own integrity and to open the church up to more exciting ideas. That's one of the things that we mentioned earlier, that I'm angry at the people in the pews because they do not do that. When they're unhappy with the pastor's beliefs, they organize. They go to the pastor and say, you've got to change. When they're unhappy because the pastor isn't challenging enough, and they just, and rather than organizing, they just disappear. They need to organize. They need to go to the pastor. They need to say, we can tolerate new ideas. We can tolerate new ways of going about this. Please challenge us.
We've been talking on Keeping the Faith this afternoon with Jack Good, who is the author of The Dishonest Church, published by Rising Star Press in association with the Center for Progressive Christianity. People who would like copies of the book may go to the website, risingstarpress.com or tcpc.org. I want to thank Dr. Good and our callers for the discussion today on this important topic. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for this program, and next week I'll be having the fun of talking with three people representing three different religions, a Muslim, a Baha'i, and a Hindu, on the topic of fasting, going without food, in some cases food and liquid, as part of a religious observance. That'll be December 5th here on Keeping the Faith. The following week, we'll be talking about the Eastern Illinois Food Bank and its programs for distributing food to needy people in Eastern Illinois. Our guest will be Jessica Culp. On December 19, we'll be talking about faith and politics with Ann Heyer, who has done a journalistic project on politics and religion. Thanks for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
According to a New York Times poll, the third most famous person in Japan is not even a person. He's a giant green radioactive lizard named Godzilla. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time, on To the Best of Our Knowledge, we'll explore the history of Japan's pop culture pioneer. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7 Central Time here on WILL Urbana. AM 580 has a listener comment line. If you'd like to comment on something you hear on the Information Advantage, call 217-333-0853 and leave a message. That's 217-333-0853. Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, mostly cloudy with a small chance of light rain or light snow after midnight, the low in the lower 30s with east winds around 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, a chance of light rain in the morning, then light rain likely in the afternoon. The high in the lower 40s with east winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with a chance of light rain. The low in the mid-30s with east winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. It's 6 p.m. Central Time. This American Life is next.